Chapter 7 An Unexpected Path to Power. Putin's salvation was not long in coming, and it came from an unlikely source: his boss's former ally turned foe, Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin had fared better with the voters than Sobchak had. His winning the presidency a second time in the summer of 1996 seemed no less miraculous than the discovery of Putin's cross in the ashes of his dacha. Yeltsin's public approval rating at the end of 1995 had dropped to 3%. The war he launched to defeat the independence movement in Chechnya in 1994, which had promised to be short and glorious, had become a bloody, humiliating stalemate. The economy had continued its remorseless collapse, and so had Yeltsin's health. Late in 1995, he had the first of what would be a series of heart attacks, the severity of which was kept from the public. Yeltsin's closest aides, those who orchestrated Yakovlev's victory over Sobchak, conspired to either cancel the election in 1996 or back an alternative to Yeltsin, the deputy prime minister, Oleg Soskovets. Even Yeltsin's wife, Naina, urged him not to run. Like wolves that gradually turned to a new leader of the pack, my closest friends had already found themselves a replacement, Yeltsin later reflected. Even those upon whom I had always depended, who were my last resort, my resource, the spiritual leaders of the nation, even they had abandoned me. Not everyone had, though. Too many fortunes relied on Yeltsin. They included Russia's richest men, bankers and media moguls who the year before had acquired the state's controlling assets in major industries in exchange for loans to keep the country's budget afloat. Boris Berezovsky, Mikhail Friedman, Vladimir Guzinski, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and Vladimir Potanin. They were the pioneers of the post-Soviet gold rush, who, through genius, guile, and grit, cobbled together vast, diverse conglomerates that would almost certainly be at risk if Yeltsin did not remain in office. Although rivals in business, they found a common cause against Yeltsin's chief opponent, the communist leader Gennady Zhuganov. Dull, heavy-browed, and shaped like a barrel, Zhuganov was by now a communist largely in name only, but he and his party represented the enormous resentment that the collapse of the Soviet Union had wrought. With the party's strong showing in parliamentary elections in 1995, it won the most Duma seats by far. It was no longer inconceivable that Zhuganov could prevail, simply because of the unpopularity of the oligarchy that had come to define Yeltsin's chaotic presidency. Musing on the fate of himself and his wealthy supporters, Yeltsin thought, "The communists will hang us from the lampposts." When Zhuganov appeared at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland in February 1996, he was greeted as a president in waiting. Something had to be done. Berezovsky, Guzinski, and Khodorkovsky thus met over dinner with another banker, Vladimir Vinogradov, and they made the Davos Pact to ensure Yeltsin's re-election in June. They offered Yeltsin's campaign millions in cash and attached their strings to it. They insisted that Anatoly Chubais, Putin's former colleague in Sobchak's entourage, and the author of the privatization programs that begot their billions, return to Yeltsin's team as his campaign manager. Chubais had been fired as deputy prime minister that January as Yeltsin lurched from scandal to scandal. With Yeltsin's daughter, Tatiana Dyachenko, Chubais orchestrated an exquisitely Russian version of the modern political campaign, bankrolled by financial schemes so ingenious and convoluted that investigators never could track all the money spent, by some estimates as much as $2 billion. Yeltsin's health and his erratic behavior were shielded from voters, his activities so carefully scripted as to almost appear normal. Berezovsky and Guzinski controlled two of the country's most popular television networks, ORT and NTV, and they produced documentaries portraying Yeltsin as the genial, healthy leader he had once been. When the election was held on June 16th, Yeltsin narrowly won a plurality with 35% of the vote, 2 million votes ahead of Zhuganov. but not enough to avoid a runoff. Alexander Lebed, a decorated general who had resigned his commission the year before to enter politics, and who opposed the war in Chechnya as a grossly mismanaged waste of lives, finished a surprising third, with 15% of the vote. Yeltsin's strategists had bolstered Lebed's campaign in the last weeks before the election with an infusion of cash and television attention in a successful effort to drain votes from Zhuganov, and now Yeltsin courted him and his voters. Yeltsin saw much to admire in Lebed. He was a tough and unbeatable guy who was racing back and forth, searching for the certainty, precision, and clarity to which he'd been accustomed and couldn't find in our new life. Yeltsin had grown disillusioned with the country's post-Soviet generals who were, he thought, missing a certain nobility, sophistication, or some sort of inner resolve. As early as 1993, he claimed, he fantasized about a new general who would appear on the political scene and guide the country with a steady, professional hand, not as a tyrant, but as a democratic leader. Lebed seemed at first to be that man, and Yeltsin considered him a potential successor as president. 2 days after the first round of voting, he appointed Lebed the secretary of the Kremlin Security Council, hoping to attract the votes he had received, but Lebed proved to be a disappointment from the onset. He was coarse and abrasive, impetuously clashing with other senior officials. Only days after his appointment, he berated a Cossack who asked him a question. "You say you are a Cossack," he interrupted the man. "Why do you speak like a Jew?" Still, Yeltsin clung to the notion of a military man as the political savior that he seemed to understand he himself would not be. "I was waiting for a new general to appear, unlike any other," Yeltsin mused. "Or rather, a general who was like the generals I read about in books when I was young." He would keep looking and find his general, though not in the army, but in another security service. Yeltsin's actions before the presidential runoff exposed the rifts between his liberal advisors, his sane forces, and the conservative faction that included Soskovets and Yeltsin's generals, Alexander Korshakov and the chairman of the Federal Security Service. Yeltsin at last understood what Sobchak had tried to warn him about months earlier. The hawks in his camp were spoiling for a fight in order to seize power in the campaign. Korshakov's presidential guards arrested two campaign aides, close associates of Chubais and Berezovsky, as they left the White House carrying a cardboard box filled with $100 bills, $500,000 in all. The arrests threatened to expose the campaign's secret financing. Yeltsin promptly fired his advisors, and a week later had another heart attack. He spent the last week in a hospital bed installed in the living room of his dacha. His campaign canceled his scheduled events and pretended nothing had happened, his aides dissembling furiously when asked about the absence of the candidate. When the runoff was held on July 2nd, Yeltsin could barely cast his ballot, choosing a polling station near his dacha rather than the one in Moscow he would normally have used. He managed to speak to a small pool of journalists, but only for a minute, before guards hustled him back to bed. And yet, in the end, Yeltsin beat Zhuganov convincingly, winning 54% of the vote, compared to 40% for the communist. More than 3 million Russians, nearly 5%, voted against all. Yeltsin had triumphed, but at an enormous cost to democratic values because of the dirty tricks, the lies, and the corrupting power of money. The outcome may have reflected the will of the electorate, but the campaign left ordinary Russians with a view of the country's democracy that was as jaded as the one they had of its capitalism. They might not favor a return to Soviet rule, but according to one exit poll, only 7% of voters approved of the democracy Russia had then. Most Russians now associated their democracy with the dishonesty, criminality, and injustice they had long been conditioned by Soviet propaganda to fear. Russia had become, as one historian put it, a nightmare vision of the West. Vladimir Putin, by all appearances, shared this view. He had helped run Yeltsin's re-election campaign in Petersburg, though he played too minor a role to attract much attention in Moscow. The furious power struggle after Yeltsin's victory, however, opened an unexpected path to the capital. Shortly after the second round ended in July, Yeltsin's hawkish chief of staff, Nikolai Yegorov, invited Putin to Moscow and offered him a position as a deputy. 2 days later, though, Yeltsin fired Yegorov and replaced him with Chubais, a reshuffling that was seen to strengthen the influence of the Kremlin's economic reformers and to repay the oligarchs for bankrolling his re-election. Chubais represented the Petersburg clan in Yeltsin's new administration, and he needed allies with experience dealing with officials and businessmen. He turned to another man left adrift by Sobchak's defeat, not Putin, but rather the other deputy, Alexei Kudrin. Kudrin, who had overseen the city's finances and budget, was much closer to Chubais in temperament and experience than Putin, whom Chubais treated with a chilly distance. Chubais appointed Kudrin the chief of the main control directorate, which served as the Kremlin's auditor, empowered to probe the finances of government agencies and the private enterprises with which they were increasingly entwined. As for Putin, Chubais eliminated the position in the administration that Putin had accepted from Yegorov only days before. The rebuff nurtured the animosity between the two men who had begun their public lives under Sobchak's tutelage. "He's so hard-nosed, like a Bolshevik," Putin would later say of Chubais. Putin returned to his limbo in Petersburg that summer. On August 18th, 3 days after his dacha burned to the ground, Putin's fortune changed. Yeltsin's prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, announced a new cabinet, appointing Alexei Bolshakov, a former legislator from Petersburg, who had been in charge of relations with the former Soviet republics, as the first deputy prime minister. Bolshakov once served on Petersburg's city council, but was forced to resign after the August 1991 putsch and wound up almost on the street. He was a twice-failed candidate for the Congress of Deputies and later the Duma, but then took over a shadowy company with plans to build a high-speed train to Moscow that never materialized, despite obtaining millions of dollars worth of loans. When he unexpectedly resurfaced in Yeltsin's administration, Putin treated him with obsequious formality during his working visits to Petersburg. "I never forced him to wait in the reception area," Putin said. "I would always stop what I was doing, kick everybody out, come into the reception area myself, and say, 'Alexei Alexeyevich, right this way.' We were never close, but maybe he remembered me." In the palace intrigue triggered by Yeltsin's infirmity, everyone was competing to expand their influence by bringing in trusted appointees. It was Kudrin who persuaded Bolshakov to consider Putin for a job. At first, Bolshakov agreed to appoint Putin to the Directorate of Public Liaison, making him effectively a spokesman. Though Putin did not relish the idea of working with the public, he accepted. He had traveled to Moscow at the end of August and slept on Kudrin's sofa. As the men drove back to the airport the next day, Kudrin called Bolshakov again, but now he had changed his mind. Bolshakov asked Putin to stay longer in Moscow, and the next day he arranged for him to meet a flamboyant bureaucrat named Pavel Borodin, who would be the man who introduced him to the inner workings of the Kremlin. Borodin was a jovial politician from Siberia who managed the Presidential Property Management Directorate. From that post, he looked after hundreds of buildings and plots of land, palaces, dachas, fleets of aircraft and yachts, hospitals, spas and hotels, art and antiques, and scores of state factories and enterprises that included everything from funeral homes to an Arctic diamond mine. By Borodin's estimate at the time, and it could only be a guess, the value of the Kremlin's assets exceeded $600 billion. Borodin showed a flair for creative capitalism, diversifying the directorate's holdings in newly emerging sectors like banking and commercial real estate. He also used the position to replenish Yeltsin's patronage mill, dispensing gifts of apartments and dachas travel and vacation vouchers. The press mockingly called his office the Ministry of Privileges. Borodin's pride and folly was an extensive renovation of the Kremlin itself, which Yeltsin began in 1994 when no one thought the country could afford the expense. In August 1996, Borodin signed a contract with a Swiss company, Mercata, for the renovation of the Grand Kremlin Palace, the former home of the Tsars that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had refitted with all the charm of a factory auditorium. The project succeeded in recreating Tsarist splendor, but the contracts with Mercata and a sister company, Mabutex, would also entangle Yeltsin and his family in an international scandal involving accusations of bribes and offshore bank accounts. Putin had met Borodin before when he once visited St. Petersburg in search of a northern dacha for Yeltsin. He also once helped when Borodin's daughter, a university student in Petersburg, fell ill. The exchange of these kinds of favors, known as blat, had been a tradition of the Tsarist and Soviet systems, where informal connections and networks cut through bureaucratic obstacles. Even in a free Russia, where money mattered more, blat remained a currency in Kremlin politics. It also helped land Putin his first job in Moscow. He was somewhat surprised that so elevated a bureaucrat, one with close ties to Yeltsin's family, would take an interest in him. Borodin, in fact, was wary of having Putin installed in his office, as were others in the directorate, who suspected that Putin was loyal to other people and organizations. Putin, for his part, was out of his element in the hothouse of conspiracy and infighting that consumed Moscow after Yeltsin's re-election and his still-secret preparations to undergo heart surgery in the fall. Even his experience in Sobchak's government had not prepared him. He was an outsider in Moscow, and also something of a naïve. As he had when he entered public life in 1991, he arranged for a television interview showing him as he moved to Moscow. "Whose man are you?" was the interviewer's first jaded question to Putin as he waited to board a flight in a lounge at Pulkovo Airport. No one, after all, rose to positions of power in Russia without a patron, and the patrons in Yeltsin's family, as in all unhappy families, were practically at war with one another. Putin, wearing an ill-fitting, luridly blue suit, demurred. "He was his father and mother's son," he replied a little too earnestly, "and no one's man." He insisted that he did not even belong to the Petersburg clan that was giving his political career a second act. "It's hard for me to imagine that some kind of group or faction even exists," he said. "I don't intend to concern myself with that. They brought me in to work." Lyudmila did not want to move. She finally felt they had a family life of their own in Petersburg, outside the cloying orbit of Putin's parents. She had no choice in the matter, though. "It always seemed to be the case that work came first for Vladimir Vladimirovich," she told a biographer, with chilly formality, "and the family second." Even Putin was reluctant to leave the familiarity of his hometown, but he felt that a job with Borodin was the best way out of my situation. Borodin's department, having the power to dispense favors, arranged for the Putins to move into a state dacha in Arkhangelskaya, a forested suburb west of Moscow. The house was old, but it had two stories with six rooms, more than enough rooms for both girls. Lyudmila soon fell in love with the capital and its bustle, the feeling that life is in full swing. By September 1996, Putin had moved into the vast presidential administration, settling into an office in a pre-revolutionary building on Staraya Ploshet, or Old Square, near the Kremlin. With him came two of his closest aides from Petersburg, Sergei Chemesov, who had served with him in Dresden, and Igor Sechin, who had been with him on Sobchak's staff from the beginning. Borodin put his new deputy in charge of the legal department and the Kremlin's vast holdings in 78 countries, embassies, schools, and other properties that once belonged to the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Putin's arrival coincided with a decree by Yeltsin that transferred control of the properties from the old ministries that had handled them in Soviet times, like the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Foreign Economic Relations, to Borodin's directorate. Many of them were in former Soviet satellites or even former republics, like Ukraine, which claimed title to the Soviet properties in their newly independent territories. It fell to Putin to make sense of the legal morass, disposing of properties that were no longer worth having and reasserting Russia's sovereignty over those that were. Putin's inventory only underscored the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the scavenging of its carcass for profit. Sometimes things came to light that made your hair stand on end, Putin's colleague Sergei Chemezov said. Dozens of shadowy corporations, proxy firms, and joint stock companies that had been mysteriously created at this time began buying up many former Soviet properties abroad, according to a young debt collector, Felipe Turover, who had uncovered some of them and, fatefully for Borodin, decided to share his evidence with prosecutors in Moscow and Switzerland. Putin was a subaltern, as a Moscow newspaper wrote at the time in a profile of this new addition to the Kremlin apparatus. He was absolutely a backstage person, whose greatest professional quality was his inconspicuousness. This probably saved him when the power struggles surrounding Yeltsin exploded in public, even as he began his new job. Alexander Lebed, Yeltsin's national security advisor, negotiated an end to the war in Chechnya in August 1996 with a peace treaty that deferred but did not resolve the republic's drive for independence. Lebed then clashed publicly over the terms with Chernomyrdin and Chubais, who distanced themselves from an agreement that seemed to give away too much to the Chechens. The public squabbling became so intense by October that the interior minister, Anatoly Kulikov, accused Lebed of staging a creeping coup and put the national police on alert across the country. Chernomyrdin called Lebed a little Napoleon. The next day, Yeltsin fired Lebed, who then forged a political alliance with Yeltsin's ousted chief of security, Alexander Korsakov, who in turn leaked a transcript of Chubais discussing efforts to squelch an investigation of the two campaign aides who had been caught with the box full of cash. The clashes unfolded as Yeltsin underwent heart surgery in November, and Putin found himself pulled deeper into the Byzantine machinations. He had not even finished his inventory of the country's foreign properties, let alone dealt with them, when he was transferred to a new job in March 1997, after only 7 months in Moscow. Alexei Kudrin was promoted and became a deputy finance minister, and on his recommendation, Putin replaced him as the head of the main control directorate. The assignment also made him a deputy chief of staff in the presidential administration, working out of a magnificent new office on Staraya Ploshad. A week after he assumed the job, a new presidential decree gave the directorate broader authority to investigate abuses in government spending throughout the country at a time when governors, state enterprises, and monopolies were taking advantage of the political and economic chaos to leech money out of the nation's coffers. Putin's task was to restore order, to end the most rampant schemes that were dragging the government and the economy ever downward. The work exposed him to the corruption that gnawed at the country, but also to the political risks of exposing those in power. Putin learned quickly that service in the Kremlin required delicacy and discretion in interpreting how far to take his investigations. Within days of taking over the directorate, Putin publicly absolved Yeltsin and a former defense minister, General Pavel Grachev, of complicity in a scandal in which the military command in the Caucasus had, from 1993 to 1996, transferred $1 billion worth of tanks and other weaponry to help Armenia in its war with Azerbaijan, despite a Russian law against arms sales to either side. To defuse the scandal, Putin granted interviews to the newspaper Kommersant and the radio station Echo Moskvy. He confirmed that the transfers had taken place and said that investigators had found those responsible, though he coyly declined to name them. "Did you find out who was connected with this supply personally?" the interviewer at Kommersant asked. "Yes, we found their names," Putin replied.
"Can you name them?"
"I would prefer not to do this before the investigation by the Prosecutor General's office and the main military prosecutor's office is complete."
"Are they officials of the Russian Ministry of Defense?" the reporter pressed.
"Yes."
"Is the name of the former Minister of Defense, Pavel Grachev, on this list?"
"No. In the course of the investigation that we carried out, we did not find any documents indicating that Grachev had given any direct instructions or directives on this score."
Putin, as an intelligence veteran, understood how to calibrate his answers, speaking as if reluctantly while spooling out exactly the information he wanted to make public and no more. Grachev, whose corruption was so notorious that he was called Pasha Mercedes for acquiring luxury automobiles under unexplained circumstances, certainly knew too much for the Kremlin to alienate him entirely, despite dismissing him. An official from the military prosecutor's office, which had already questioned Grachev, complained anonymously that it was premature for Putin to exonerate anyone. Overseeing the directorate took Putin across the country and brought him into close contact with the general prosecutor's office and the security agencies, including the Federal Security Service, or FSB, which was the domestic successor of the KGB, responsible for internal security, counter-espionage, and counter-terrorism, and still headquartered in the KGB's ominous building on Lubyanka Square. He discovered the extent to which Russia's government was failing on almost every level, its authority ignored, its resources wasted by governors and other officials who were conspiring with new entrepreneurs to pilfer as much as they could. Although he did not have prosecutorial power, he did have the authority of the Kremlin to scour budgets and contracts, to conduct investigations and compile thick dossiers of incriminating evidence for use when necessary. The information gave him power and influence. He became a modern-day revisor, the government inspector of Gogol's satirical play, whose expected arrival in a village struck such fear in mendacious local officials that they heaped tribute on an unsuspecting fop in a case of mistaken identity. By the end of his first month on the job, Putin had declared a deputy transportation minister, Anatoly Nasonov, incompetent after selective checks in 18 regions found that billions of dollars had been expropriated from the Federal Road Fund. By May 1997, he had expanded his inquiries to a third of the country's 89 regions or republics and charged 260 officials with malfeasance. By September, he had announced disciplinary action against 450 officials and stressed the particularly glaring evidence of budgetary abuse in the Stavropol and Tver regions. Putin impressed his superiors with his diligence in seeking to reassert Kremlin authority, albeit selectively, and with it replenish the government's coffers. He also unnerved them at times. Boris Nemtsov, a young deputy prime minister whom Yeltsin appointed the same month that Putin took over the directorate, remembered Putin's delivering a report on theft and corruption his department had uncovered at a foundation created by Anatoly Chubais, who had passed him over for a job in 1996. The report ended with a salutation that Nemtsov, a reform-minded Democrat, felt was the language of an intelligence operative. "Reporting at your discretion." Nemtsov called him for explanation, saying that if he believed that a crime had been committed, he should forward it to prosecutors instead of writing that. "What does it mean?" he asked his subordinate. Putin was not long in answering. "You are the boss, and you decide." Putin had been thinking about the country's economic problems for some time. In May 1996, while still in Petersburg, Putin had formally enrolled in a university to obtain the graduate degree he had first considered when he returned from Dresden. Advanced degrees always had a cachet in the Soviet Union and Russia, and Putin's decision to seek one reflected a desire to burnish his credentials, a need that became even more acute after Sobchak's defeat. As when he matriculated at Leningrad State with the goal of joining the KGB, Putin saw education as a means to an end, not an end in itself. He did not return to the law department of his university for a higher degree, though. Instead, he chose the prestigious mining institute named after Georgi Plekhanov, a pre-revolutionary theorist called the father of Russian Marxism. And he settled not on legal affairs, but rather on a subject that he understood was vital to Russia's future, natural resources. He was not alone. Viktor Zubkov and Igor Sechin, both close associates in Sobchak's government, also enrolled at the institute, producing theses on the subject of Russia's natural resources. Their interest stemmed from the city's many investments in fuel companies, pipelines, and ports. As Sobchak's deputy, Putin had, in 1995, drafted a report for the federal government on the need to improve the region's export of natural resources by restructuring Petersburg's ports, and that served as the basis for the thesis that Putin set out to complete. The product, 218 pages long in the original Russian with graphs and appendixes, was dry in tone and dense with facts and figures on the natural resources of the region surrounding Petersburg. Not oil or gas, but bauxite, phosphates, clay, sand, gravel, cement, and peat. These resources remained underdeveloped after the Soviet collapse and needed strategic government investment in order to thrive. The thesis anticipated an economic policy focused on Russia's immense natural resources, grounded in the emerging free market. It argued for appropriate regulatory and procedural recommendations, though not a reassertion of state control over economic development. Putin seemed to have neither attended courses at the university nor had the time to write a complicated thesis, given the demands of Sobchak's re-election campaign, his search for a new job, and the subsequent move to Moscow. He appears to have done what many Russians did at the time, especially busy public officials. He had someone else ghostwrite it for him. The estranged daughter of the institute's rector, Vladimir Litvinenko, would later claim that her father had written the thesis for Putin. Litvinenko, who was an expert in mineralogy, went on to join the board of Foss Agro, one of the world's largest producers of fertilizers made from phosphates, which were found in abundance in the Petersburg region, as the thesis noted. He became a very rich man, though that would not become known for many years since the company's owners then remained secret. Whoever the author or authors, Putin's thesis lifted almost verbatim more than 16 pages of text and 6 charts from an American textbook written by 2 professors at the University of Pittsburgh, which was translated into Russian in 1982, almost certainly at the behest of or with the approval of the KGB, which under Andropov was eager to find a way out of the Soviet Union's economic stagnation. The thesis's bibliography includes the textbook Strategic Planning and Policy by William R. King and David I. Cleland as one of 47 sources, including papers and lectures by Putin at the Institute. But in the text itself, the work is neither credited explicitly, nor are the lengthy passages lifted from its Russian translation acknowledged. Instead, the number 23, its place in the bibliography, is simply inserted between brackets in 2 places. The evident plagiarism would be grounds for failure at American or European universities, though it was an accepted practice in Soviet and Russian academia to cut and paste texts with minimal citation. In any case, it was not detected for years. Putin seemed indifferent to the academic undertaking. He rarely mentioned it during the writing or afterward, though he did list it on his resumes, which had probably been the point in the first place. It is possible he was embarrassed by its academic unscrupulousness, or the improbable facility with advanced mathematics that he had never displayed as a student. The thesis nevertheless showed an interest in the economics of natural resources that was a fixation for the circle of friends he had gathered in Petersburg, and later at the Ozora Dacha Cooperative founded in 1996. Putin defended the thesis at the Mining Institute in June 1997, and one of those critiquing his presentation described his defense as brilliant. Now, in Moscow, he was in a position to influence the distribution of those resources on a national, not regional, level. An international commercial dispute over a gold deposit in Siberia, for example, prompted Putin to write a report in 1997 recommending the dismissal of the first deputy minister of natural resources, Boris Yatskevich. Yatskevich served in the ministry that granted mining permits, even as he served as chairman of the board of the company Lenzilata, which held the license to the deposit. Putin found the arrangement a flagrant violation of the law. As was typical in Yeltsin's government, nothing happened. In fact, Yatskevich went on to become the Minister of Natural Resources. Putin, though, began to formulate strong views about the necessity of re-exerting state authority to put an end to the pilfering of the country's most precious assets. In an essay published in the Mining Institute's annual periodical 2 years later, he argued that natural resources would prop up Russia's economy for at least the first half of the 21st century, but they would require foreign investment and the strong guiding hand of the state in licensing and regulating the exploitation of the riches buried beneath the vast expanse of Eurasia. Few academics ever have the chance to put their ideas so directly into practice, but Putin soon would. First, though, he had another piece of unfinished business in Petersburg. Anatoly Sobchak's exile from power had not been tranquil. The investigation that had begun during his re-election campaign had not ended, not even after Yeltsin dismissed those who had plotted against Sobchak's re-election. They might have left office, Sobchak noted, but they had not left the abyss in which they flew. And they had allies in the parliament, which by April 1997 passed a resolution calling on the Prosecutor General's office to finish the various investigations into the heinous crimes of Sobchak and several of his deputies. Meanwhile, Sobchak's public commentary on political affairs won him no allies inside the Kremlin. In January 1997, he criticized Yeltsin's leadership, saying his illnesses had created virtual anarchy and the criminalization of authority. By July, one of his advisors, Larisa Karchenko, was arrested and charged with negotiating bribes paid by the head of the construction company Renaissance, and Sobchak was summoned as a witness. The arrest of his chief of staff, Viktor Kruchinin, followed. All summer, leaks filled newspapers with details of the case and speculation that Sobchak himself was about to be arrested. He complained that his phone was tapped and that he was followed everywhere he went by agents of the FSB, even as he ignored a dozen summonses to testify and denied he had done anything illegal in privatizing city property. He had reason to be paranoid. He was caught in Yeltsin's highly publicized, if not particularly serious, campaign against corruption, one in which Putin himself was playing a prominent role. On October 3rd, investigators and 10 heavily armed special police arrived at Sobchak's office, now in the UNESCO headquarters, and arrested him as a material witness. While being questioned in the prosecutor's office, Sobchak complained of chest pains and was taken to the hospital. His wife said he suffered a heart attack, though no one believed it, and the hospital's doctors did not confirm it. Either way, he was well enough the next day to fulminate to the news agency Itar Chas that the investigators' work recalled the Great Terror of 1937. "Only in 1937 they would have killed me," he said. Sobchak spent a month in the hospital, his fate resting on the diagnoses of physicians. Even Yeltsin, whose antipathy for Sobchak had grown, felt the prosecution was going too far. He sent a message to the prosecutor general, Yuri Skuratov: "You can't harass a sick man." But the prosecutors pressed on. They doubted Sobchak's claims about his health and arranged to have doctors from Moscow examine him. Before they could arrive, though, Putin intervened. Putin visited Sobchak in the hospital and arranged for his transfer to the Military Medical Academy under the care of Yuri Shevchenko, who had treated Lyudmila after her car accident and remained a close and trusted friend. Then he plotted Sobchak's escape. On November 7th, a holiday still, although it no longer officially celebrated the Bolshevik Revolution, Putin collected Sobchak's medical records and chartered an aircraft from Finland at a cost of $30,000, paid for, according to Sobchak's wife, by friends, though some reports said the source was the cellist Mstislav Rostropovich. Putin called on his old contacts in the local police and intelligence service to accompany an ambulance that quietly transferred Sobchak from the hospital ward to a waiting plane at Pulkovo Airport. Despite the warrants for Sobchak's arrests, the public furor over his case, and his own vows to remain in Russia to defend himself against the charges, he and his wife, Lyudmila Narusova, passed through customs on the tarmac, had their passports stamped, and flew to Paris. Putin's involvement was certainly audacious and very likely illegal, even if the Sobchak's documents were in order. As he had in 1991, he risked his own future out of loyalty to the charismatic, flawed leader who had been a friend and a mentor. Only in a country where the justice system had broken down could he have succeeded in spiriting Sobchak to safety abroad. Only in a dysfunctional political system could his brazen defiance of the law have earned him admiration, and not just among his close circle of friends. Sobchak's flight created a furor, and Putin's role in the affair did not remain secret for long. Putin understood the injustice of what was happening to his former boss and political mentor better than anyone, one admirer wrote later. Putin sensed danger more quickly and acutely than others, and acted out of loyalty and nothing more. When I learned that Putin had helped send Sobchak abroad, I had mixed feelings. Putin had taken a great risk, yet I profoundly admired his actions. The admirer was Boris Yeltsin, and when he mulled the infighting and betrayals of his appointees, he felt awe at such a display of loyalty.